3 o'clock. Good afternoon. This is Luke Tuddenham. Time for our 60-minute drama now, and we find Boswell relying on Johnson more and more in Boswell's Life of Johnson. In an hour, Mel Gedroych will be following a photographer chasing the Northern Lights in the 4 o'clock show, and in the evening we'll have 45 minutes of Shakespeare, coffee and croissants in our drama at 9:15, Shakespeare à la carte. Now, Kenneth Cranham stars as Samuel Johnson and Paul Higgins is James Boswell in the second part of Boswell's Life of Johnson, dramatised by Robin Brooks.
I am now to record a very curious incident in Dr. Johnson's life which fell under my own observation. My desire of being acquainted with celebrated men had led me, much about the same time, to obtain an introduction to Mr. John Wilkes. Two men more different could perhaps not be selected out of all mankind. They had even attacked one another with some asperity in their writings, yet I lived in habits of friendship with both. I conceived an irresistible wish to bring Dr. Johnson and Mr. Wilkes together. How to manage it was a nice and difficult matter. My worthy bookseller, Mr. Dilly, had invited me to dine with Mr. Wilkes.
Pray, let us have Dr. Johnson.
What? With Mr. Wilkes? Not for the world. Dr. Johnson would never forgive me.
Come, if you'll let me negotiate for you, I will be answerable that all shall go well.
Nay, if you will take it upon you, I'm sure I shall be very happy to see them both here.
Notwithstanding the high veneration which I entertained for Dr. Johnson, I was sensible that he was sometimes a little actuated by the spirit of contradiction, and by means of that I hoped I should gain my point. I therefore, while we were sitting quietly by ourselves in his house in an evening, took occasion to open my plan thus.
Mr. Dilly, sir, sends his respectful compliments to you, and would be happy if you would do him the honour to dine with him on Wednesday next, as I must soon go to Scotland.
Sir, I'm obliged to Mr. Dilly. I will wait upon him.
Provided, sir, I suppose, that the company which he is to have is agreeable to you.
What do you mean, sir? What do you take me for? Do you think I'm so ignorant of the world as to imagine that I am to prescribe to a gentleman what company he is to have at his table?
I beg your pardon, sir, for wishing to prevent you from meeting people whom you might not like. Perhaps he may have some of what he calls his patriotic friends with
him. Well, sir, and what then? What care I for his patriotic friends, Paul?
Well, I should not be surprised to find Jack Wilkes there.
And if Jack Wilkes is there, what is that to me, sir? My dear friend, let us have no more of this. I'm sorry to be angry with you, but really, it is treating me strangely to talk to me as if I could not meet any company whatever occasionally.
Pray forgive me, sir. I meant well.
Thus I secured him. Upon the much-expected Wednesday, I called on him about half an hour before dinner to see that he was ready on time. I found him very busy putting his books in order, and as they were generally very old ones, clouds of dust were flying around him. He had on a pair of large gloves, such as hedgers use. His appearance put me in mind of my uncle's description of him, a robust genius born to grapple with whole libraries.
Bozzy! This is a pleasure, sir.
How is this, sir? Don't you recollect that you are going to dine at Mr. Dilly's?
Sir, it went out of my head. I've ordered dinner at home with Mrs. Williams.
But, my dear sir, you know you were engaged to Mr. Dilly, and I told him so. He will expect you and will be much disappointed if you don't come.
Well, you must talk to Mrs. Williams about this.
Here was a sad dilemma. He had accustomed himself to show Mrs. Williams such a degree of humane attention that if she would be obstinate, he would not stir. I hastened down to the poor blind old lady's room.
Oh, Mrs. Williams.
Sir?
Forgive me, madam. I am in great uneasiness.
How so, sir?
Dr. Johnson has engaged to me to dine this day at Mr. Dilly's, but he has told me that he has forgotten this engagement and has ordered dinner at home.
Yes, sir. Dr. Johnson is to dine at home, and what of that?
Madam, his respect for you is such that I know he will not leave you unless you absolutely desire it. But as you have so much of his company, I hope you will be good enough to forgo it for a day.
Eh?
Mr. Dilly is a very worthy man and will be vexed if the doctor neglects him today.
So?
And then, madam, be pleased to consider my situation. I carried the message and I assured Mr. Dilly that Dr. Johnson was to come. And no doubt he has made a dinner and invited a company and boasted of the honour he was to have. I shall be quite disgraced if the doctor is not there. Oh, please, Mrs. Williams, dear Mrs. Williams, dearest lady, let me give you a bus.
Mr. Boswell.
Gracious lady.
Well, you may tell him that all things considered, he should go.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Williams. I flew back to him, still in dust and indifferent in his choice to go or stay. But as soon as I had announced to him Mrs. Williams' consent...
Frank! Frank! A clean shirt!
Very soon I had him seated in a hackney coach and I exulted as much as a fortune hunter who has got an heiress in a postchaise with him to set out for Gretna Green. When we entered Mr. Dilly's drawing room, he found himself in the midst of a company he did not know. I kept myself snug and silent.
Mr. Dilly.
Dr. Johnson.
Who is that gentleman?
Mr. Arthur Lee.
Is he?
He is an American.
An American? And who is that gentleman in lace?
Mr. Wilkes, sir.
Dinner is upon the table.
Mr. Wilkes placed himself next to Dr. Johnson and behaved to him with so much attention and politeness that he gained upon him insensibly.
Pray, give me leave to carve you some of this veal. Some fat, sir? A little of the stuffing, some gravy. Let me have the pleasure of giving you some butter. Allow me to recommend a squeeze of this orange. Or the lemon, perhaps, may have more zest.
Sir, I'm obliged to you.
Mr. Wilkes, sir, what do you think of Foote, the comedian?
Merry Andrew, a buffoon.
But he has wit, too. He's not deficient in ideas.
Garrick's wit.
Garrick's wit is under many restraints from which Foote is free. First time I was in company with Foote, having no good opinion of the fellow, I was resolved not to be pleased. It's very difficult to please a man against his will. I went on eating my dinner pretty sullenly, affecting not to mind him, but the dog was so very comical. I was obliged to lay down my knife and fork, throw myself back upon my chair, and fairly laugh it out. No, sir, he was irresistible.
Say you so, sir. Mr. Boswell listens to your talk with great attention, Dr. Johnson.
Oh, he has but two topics, himself and me, Mr. Wilkes, and I'm sick of both.
Oh, well, that is no disrespect. Quite the opposite. Another glass of wine with you, Mr. Wilkes?
With pleasure, sir.
Every man is to take existence on the terms on which it is given to him. One man may drink wine and be nothing the worse for it. On another, wine may have effects so inflammatory as to injure him both in body and mind, and perhaps make him commit something for which he may deserve to be hanged.
Do you mean me, sir?
You do have a certain reputation, Mr. Boswell.
As a drinker?
As perhaps a biographer?
I heard of an enterprising countryman of yours, Mr. Boswell, who's settled on the Mississippi and says he will make wine there. But it is a barren place.
Why, sir, all barrenness is comparative. The Scotch would not know it to be barren.
Oh, come, sir. You have now been in Scotland, and say if you did not see meat and drink enough there.
Why, yes, sir, meat and drink enough to give the inhabitants sufficient strength to run away from home.
Oh, you will, yes.
You must know, Mr. Wilkes, I lately took my friend Boswell and showed him genuine civilised life in an English provincial town. I turned him loose at Lichfield that he might see for once real civility. For you know he lives among savages in Scotland and among rakes in London.
Except when he is with grave, sober, decent people like you and me.
And we're ashamed of him.
Oh, you will have your jest. They were quite frank and easy, and I did not resent their flights at my expense, but rather hugged myself at the success of my venture. In the evening, the company was entertained with tunes on the fiddle. While some of the tunes were played with no great skill, my frame was agitated and I was conscious of a generous attachment to Johnson as my preceptor and friend, mixed with an affectionate regret that he was an old man whom I should probably lose in a short time. I thought I could defend him at the point of my sword. My reverence and affection for him were in full glow. My dear sir, we must meet every year, if you don't quarrel with me.
Nay, sir, you are more likely to quarrel with me than I am with you.
This year was distinguished by his being introduced into the family of Mr. and Mrs. Thrale. Mr. Thrale was one of the most eminent brewers in England and Member of Parliament for the Borough of Southwark.
How do you do?
Mrs. Thrale was a woman of lively talents.
So pleased, Mr. Boswell.
The pleasure is mine, Mrs. Thrale.
Johnson's introduction into the family, which contributed so much to the happiness of his life, was owing to her desire for his conversation.
And to think, the great man in my little parlour, Mr. Boswell.
Mrs. Thrale was short, plump and brisk. She has herself given us a lively view of the idea which Johnson had of her person on her appearance before him in a dark-coloured gown.
You little creatures should never wear those sort of clothes. They're unsuitable in every way. Have not all insects gay colours?
Dr. Johnson, how dare you make such a metaphor in my own hive and eating my own honey?
Why, because...
Mrs. Thrale was enchanted with Johnson's conversation for its own sake and had also a very allowable vanity in appearing to be honoured with the attention of so celebrated a man. I had the pleasure of seeing Dr. Johnson at Mrs. Thrale's. He was much there and less engaged now in his literary labours.
When business is done, what remains but pleasure? And where should pleasure be sought but under Mrs. Thrale's influence?
Oh, Dr. Johnson!
Madam, forgive me.
I had conversation enough with her to admire her talents, alas, alas, and to show her that I was as Johnsonian as herself, when I was invited to dine at Streatham.
How do you go on with him? I never know what he will say.
One must learn to please.
I do not know for certain what will please Dr. Johnson, but I know for certain that it will displease him to praise anything, even what he likes, extravagantly.
At dinner he laughed at querulous declamations against the age on account of luxury, increase of London, scarcity of provisions and other such topics. I mentioned that I had in my possession the life of Sir Robert Sibbald.
It is, I believe, the most natural and candid account of himself that was ever given by any man.
How, as an instance?
He tells how he embraced the ancient religion, continued very steady in it for some time, but found the rigid fasting imposed by the church very severe, and so returned to Protestantism.
I think you had better let it alone. To discover such weakness exposes a man when he is gone.
It is an honest picture of human nature. How often are the primary motives of our greatest actions as small as Sibyl's?
But may they not as well be forgotten?
No, madam. A man loves to review his own mind. That is the use of a diary or journal.
As the ladies love to see themselves in a glass.
A very pretty illusion. As a lady adjusts her dress before a mirror, so Boswell adjusts his character by looking at his journal.
I had, before dinner, repeated a ridiculous story told me by an old man who had been a passenger with me in the stagecoach today. Mrs. Thrale called it...
The story told you by the old woman.
No, madam. Give me leave to catch you in the fact. It was not an old woman, but an old man.
I presumed to take an opportunity, in presence of Johnson, of showing this lively lady how ready she was, unintentionally, to deviate from the exact authenticity of narration. He gave a very earnest recommendation of what he himself practised with the utmost conscientiousness.
A strict attention to truth. Accustom your children, mistress, constantly to this. If a thing happened at one window, and they, when relating it, say it happened at another, do not let it pass. but instantly check them. You do not know where deviation from truth will end.
But little variations in narrative must happen 1,000 times a day if one is not perpetually watching.
Well, madam, you ought to be perpetually watching. It is more from carelessness about the truth than from intentional lying that there is so much falsehood in the world.
Before a meeting of our celebrated club, we are all invited to dinner at the House of the Thrales. The drawing room, how rich! Garrick, Miss Hannah Moore, the blue stocking, our musical friend, Dr. Burney, our old friend Langton, Sir Joshua Reynolds, Mr. and Mrs. Thrale. I sat a little quiet and enjoyed the scene, the lustre in light and in genius. I went up to Garrick.
Ah, Mr. Garrick.
Basil.
He hardly took notice. Ridiculous importance. But I sat down on the settee beside them. I was desirous of calling Johnson forth to talk and exercise his wit, and though I should take myself to be the object of it, I resolutely ventured to undertake the defence of convivial indulgence in wine, though he was not in the most genial humour.
In vino veritas, a man who is well warmed with wine will speak truth.
Why, sir, that may be an argument for drinking if you suppose men in general to be liars. But, sir, I would not keep company with a fellow who lies as long as he is sober and whom you must make drunk before you can get a word of truth out of him.
Drinking wine is a pleasure which I am unwilling to give up.
Why, sir, there is no doubt that not to drink wine is a great deduction from life.
Yeah.
But it may be necessary. I require wine only when I am alone. I have then often wished for it and often taken it.
By way of a companion, sir?
To get rid of myself. Wine gives great pleasure, and every pleasure is of itself a good. Wine makes a man better pleased with himself. But the danger is, he may be growing less pleasing to others. Wine gives a man nothing. It neither gives him knowledge or wit. It only animates a man and enables him to bring out what a dread of company has repressed. This may be good, or it may be bad.
So wine is a key which opens a box, but the box may be full or empty.
Well said, Mrs. Thrale.
Nay, madam, conversation is the key. Wine is a picklock which forces open the box and injures it. A man should cultivate his mind so as to have that confidence and readiness without wine, which wine gives.
The great difficulty of resisting wine is from benevolence. For instance, a good worthy man asks you to taste his wine, which he has had 20 years in his cellar.
Sir, all this notion about benevolence arises from a man imagining himself to be of more importance to others than he really is. They don't care a farthing whether he drinks or not.
But to please one's company is a strong motive.
I won't argue with you any more, sir. You are too far gone.
Well, I should have thought so indeed, sir, had I made such a speech as you have now done.
Hey, don't be angry. I did not mean to offend you.
2 years ago, Mr. Boswell swore to give up wine and become a water drinker.
What became of that?
You was my tempter, Mr. Garrick. Oh. You lured me back to the bottle.
Well, had I made a resolution, been driven from it so, I should have hid my head for a year.
It gave the company a better opinion of you that you yielded, Mr. Boswell. Sir, there he was, drinking water with his book to take down our conversation.
I do not approve.
Let it be the law of the club. Either drink or we'll search him that he mayn't have his book. If he won't let wine search him, we will.
That is nonsense. As if I had a book and wrote in company and could not carry in my head.
Carry in your head? I do not believe it.
After dinner, there was a very large company and a great deal of conversation. But owing to some circumstance which I cannot now recollect, I have no record of any part of it.
And guess what that gentleman might be? Why, none other than our own Mr. Boswell.
But there were several people there by no means of the Johnsonian school, so that less attention was paid to him than usual, which put him out of humour.
and upon some imaginary offence from me, he attacked me with such rudeness that I was vexed and angry.
Sir, I am a great friend to public amusements, for they keep people from vice. You, Bozzy, would have been with a wench had you not been here. Oh, I forgot you were married.
I was so much hurt and had my pride so roused that I kept away from him for a week, and perhaps might have kept away much longer, nay, gone to Scotland without seeing him again. But the next week, I dined with him in company with Mrs. Williams and Mrs. Desmoulins. I was reserved and silent, which I suppose he perceived. After dinner, when we were by ourselves, he drew his chair near to mine.
Well, how have you done?
Sir, you have made me very uneasy by your behaviour to me when we were last at the Thrales. You know, my dear sir, no man has a greater respect and affection for you, or would sooner go to the end of the world to serve you.
You interrupted me.
No, sir, I did not. But in any case, why treat me so before people who do not love me? Mrs. Thrale...
Mrs. Thrale has a sincere regard for you. Well, I'm sorry for it. I'll make it up to you 20 different ways as you please.
I said today to Sir Joshua, when he observed that you tossed me sometimes, I don't care how often or how high, when only friends are present, for then I fall upon soft ground, but I do not like falling upon stones, which is the case when enemies are present. I think this is a pretty good image, sir.
Sir, it is one of the happiest I have ever heard. Bozzy...
We surely cannot but admire the benevolent exertions of this great and good man, especially when we consider how grievously he was afflicted with bad health, and how uncomfortable his home was made by the perpetual jarring of those whom he charitably accommodated under his roof, despite his own very straitened means. He has sometimes suffered me to talk jocularly of his group of females and call them his seraglio. He thus mentions them, together with the honest Dr. Levitt, in one of his letters.
Williams hates everybody, Levitt hates Desmoulins and does not love Williams, Desmoulins hates them both, Paul loves none of them.
Paul Carmichael was a woman of the streets. Dr. Johnson found her lying there, near lifeless one day, carried her home on his back, took her in and cared for her. She has lived with him for many years, though she does not accord well with the house.
Because she is a stupid slut, sir.
But it was in conversation with Mrs. Desmoulins, who had known Dr. Johnson since the days of his marriage, when she was a young girl and he no more than 30, it was in conversation with this old lady that I made a strange discovery. After dinner, when the doctor had retired to take a nap and Mrs. Williams was also gone, Mrs. Desmoulins and I remained. Now, ma'am, let us be free. We are both married people. Pray tell me, do you really think Dr. Johnson ever offended in point of chastity? I do not believe he ever did. Is it true that he was even chaste with his wife?
Sir, you are much mistaken. There never was a man who had stronger amorous inclinations than Dr. Johnson. But he conquered them.
I do not believe he ever has had any serious inclination for women. I do not believe his marriage was consummated.
Nay, sir, Garrick knew it was consummated, for he peeped through the keyhole and behaved like a rascal. For he made the doctor ridiculous all over the county by describing him running round the bed after she'd lain down and crying,
I'm coming, my Tetsy! I'm coming, my Tetsy!
She was near 50 when the doctor married her, and he was only 22, and I believe she never had any love for him but only to get money from him when he found a position. They did not sleep together for many years. But that was her fault. She drank shockingly and said she was not well and could not bear a bedfellow. And I remember once when at Hampstead a young woman came on a visit, I lay in the room with Mrs. Johnson in a small bed. She said, it will not hold you both, so if you promise not to tell Mr. Johnson, you shall sleep with me. But if he should know this, he'd say, if you can bear a bedfellow, why not me as well as another?
Perhaps he was so bad a bedfellow she could not bear him, and this made her take to drinking. He had no passion.
Nay, sir, I tell you, no man had stronger, and nobody had an opportunity to know more about that than I had.
I am sure, madam, were I to indulge that passion, I should think you a very agreeable object. But from what you have said, I beg leave to ask you if the doctor ever made any attempt upon you.
No, sir. I have told you he commanded his passion. But when I was a young woman and lived with Mrs. Johnson at Hampstead, when they were living apart, he used to come 2 or 3 days in the week and out until 2 or 3 in the morning. The maid went to bed, as she could not be kept up, and I used to sit up for him. And I have warmed his bed with a pan of coals and sat with him in his room many an hour in the night and had my head on his pillow.
What, when he was in bed?
Yes, sir. He'd desire me to go out of the room and he'd go to bed, but to come back in a little while.
Talk to me, dear lady.
And I have come and sat on his bedside and laid my head on his pillow.
And he showed strong signs of that passion?
Yes, sir. But I always respected him as a father.
What would he do? Would he fondle you? Would he kiss you?
Yes, sir.
Dear lady. Dear lady.
But he never did anything that was beyond the limits of decency.
He conquered his violent inclination?
Yes, sir. He'd push me from him and cry,
get you gone.
Oh, one can see.
So you saw the struggle and the conquest?
I did. I do own I could not have had resolution to have resisted him.
I cannot imagine it of any woman. There is something in his figure so terribly disgusting.
Yet, sir, one cannot tell. His mind is such. You know, sir, he spent hundreds of pounds in supporting Betty, my Scotch maid, afterwards maid to Mrs. Williams. She was an abandoned, diseased creature, and when the workhouse was proposed, he said no. Her feelings are as delicate as yours.
Strange.
The greater part of each year I spent on my estate and my legal practice in Scotland. I had taken a wife and in time became a father, but for 3 or 4 precious months I would to London each spring and there pick up the threads of old friendship. Having so arrived in London one April morning, I hastened to wait on Dr. Johnson at his house. Being informed that he was at Mr. Thrale's in Streatham, I went thither and found them in talk. I was kindly welcomed. He was in full glow of conversation, and I felt myself elevated as if brought into another state of being.
There is great spirit and power in what Burton says, Mr. Thrale. How many times...
Mrs. Thrale and I looked to each other while he talked, and our looks expressed our congenial admiration and affection for him.
How is your wife, Mr. Boswell? How is Scotland?
Oh, very well, Mrs. Thrale. But how pleasant it is to be here. I am intellectually restored by the doctor, by transfusion of mind.
There are many who admire and respect Mr. Johnson, but you and I love him.
We all then spoke of love.
Those who were never in love never were happy. For nature will vindicate her own feelings and revenge the insults offered her.
My peace has never been disturbed by the soft passion, so it seldom comes into my head to talk about it.
Madam, no person ever yet treated the passion of love with contempt, except from stupidity or disappointment.
What is love, apart from that well-known passion raised by desire?
2 other sorts. Love that one feels for one's friend, the delight one has in his company, the pride one shares in his praises. The other is that love which is excited by tenderness, as the love one has for one's children.
When my daughters are growing, I shall keep them out of the world so much as I can.
But solitude is the nurse of love. In the tumult of company, a girl has neither time nor inclination to listen to tender speeches. The ball, the show are not dangerous things, no. 'Tis the tête-à-tête, the private friend, the kind consoler, the constant companion that is dangerous. The public lover is not to be feared.
Not for all.
If you shut up any man and woman for 6 months together, they will inevitably fall in love.
If young enough.
But if at the end of that term you would throw each of them into assemblies and let them change partners at pleasure, they would soon forget their mutual attachment.
Come in to dine, my dear sir.
He seemed very happy with Mr. and Mrs. Thrale. They were so much pleased with him that his invitations to their house were more and more frequent, till at last he became one of the family, and an apartment was appropriated to him in their house at Southwark and their villa at Streatham.
You do great good for him, madam. It is a great kindness to see to his wants and give him the pleasures and comforts that otherwise he could not obtain.
At what cost to myself, Mr. Boswell? Mr. Johnson loves late hours. Nothing is more terrifying to him than the idea of retiring to bed, which he never allows going to rest. As a result, I hurt my own health not a little by sitting up with him when I am myself far from well. I am forced by his vehement lamentations to sit quietly and make tea for him till 4 o'clock in the morning. He is frequently on the verge of a quarrel. "Have a care," he says. "The old lion will not bear to be tickled."
About this time, Dr. Johnson fell prey to a desperate melancholy.
"Hester, the black dog is on my back."
He lamented to me the horrible condition of his mind. Mr. Boswell was in Scotland, so who should help him?
Hester.
Mr. Thrale and I took him in and nursed him, and for a great while he was more with us in Streatham than in his own house. His behaviour became more and more dependent on me. How many times has this great, this formidable Dr. Johnson kissed my hand, aye, and my foot too, upon his knees?
A woman has such power between the ages of 25 and 45 that she may tie a man to a post and whip him if she will.
And when the black dog visited, he could not trust himself.
Shall I keep to my room? You must restrain me. Your judgment and vigilance may come to the rescue of my weakness. I desire that you should hold me in a slavery that you can make happy for me.
My dear sir, shake off these uneasy weights. Forget yourself. Take wine.
No.
Do not quarrel with your governess for not using the rod enough. Dissipation is a glorious medicine. I believe Mr. Boswell will be at last your best physician.
There is no help for me.
And then, alas, after many troubles, my poor Thrale expired.
I was in the house. I felt almost the last flutter of his pulse and looked for the last time upon the face that for some years had never been turned upon me but with respect and benignity.
Mr. Thrale's death was a very essential loss to Johnson, who, although he did not foresee all that afterwards happened, continued to show a kind attention to his widow and children. One day, as he was engaged to dine with Mrs. Thrale, I called on him and accompanied him in a hackney carriage. We stopped first at Wergman's, the well-known toy shop in St. James Street, to which he had been directed, but not clearly, for he searched about some time and could not find it at first.
To direct one to a corner shop is toying with one.
I suppose you mean that as a play upon the word toy? It was the first time I heard him stoop to such sport. After he had been some time in the shop, he sent for me to come out of the coach.
Come and help me choose a pair of silver shoe buckles. These I have are too small.
Has this alteration been suggested by Mrs. Thrale?
Sir, I will not have the ridiculous large buckles now in fashion, and I will give you no more than a guinea for a pair.
Such were the principles of the business, and after some examination...
Too big.
Sir.
Too expensive.
Sir.
Too small.
Sir.
He was fitted. His external appearance was much improved by his association with Mrs. Thrale. He got better clothes, and the dark colour from which he never deviated was enlivened by metal buttons. Had I not known him better, I would have thought he dressed himself like a lover. On Friday, June the 21st, I was glad to find him at Mrs. Thrale's house. I was shown into the room still kept for him.
I'm glad you have come. I'm very ill.
He looked pale and was distressed with difficulty of breathing. But after the common inquiries, he assumed his usual strong, animated style of conversation. He sent a message to acquaint Mrs. Thrale that I was arrived. I had not seen her since her husband's death. She soon appeared and favoured me with an invitation to stay to dinner.
I'm very glad you have come, Mr. Boswell, for I'm going to Bath and I should have been sorry to leave Dr. Johnson before you came.
This seemed to be attentive and kind, and I, who had not been informed of any change, imagined all to be as well as formerly. He was little inclined to talk at dinner and went to sleep after it, but when he joined us in the drawing room he seemed revived and was again himself.
For conversation, there must, in the first place, be knowledge. There must be materials. In the second place, there must be a command of words. In the third place, there must be imagination to place things in such views as they are not commonly seen.
Oh, Mrs. Thrale, for shorthand, to take this time.
In the fourth place, there must be presence of mind.
But you carry it all in your head, Mr. Boswell. A long head is as good as shorthand.
And a resolution that is not to be overcome by failures. This last is an essential requisite.
But the death of Mr. Thrale had made a very material alteration with respect to Johnson's reception in that family. The manly authority of the husband no longer curbed the lively exuberance of the lady, and as her vanity had been fully gratified by having the colossus of literature attached to her for many years, she gradually became less assiduous to please him. Whether her attachment to him was already divided by another object, I am unable to ascertain, but it is plain that Johnson's penetration was alive to her neglect or forced attention.
My lawsuit with Lady Salisbury turns out worse than I could have dreamed on. I must go abroad to save money. Mr. Piozzi will be our guide.
Signor Piozzi, the music master, he's not...
He is a native. He is the dearest, kindest man. To show Italy to my girls and be showed it by him has long been my dearest wish.
For how long?
It shocks me to leave you.
Piozzi!
I mentioned the matter to my eldest daughter, whose prudence and solid judgment, unbiased by passion, is unequalled. She approves the scheme and means to partake it, though she is perfectly aware that temptations might arise to prevent me from ever returning.
Signor Piozzi?
He is an angel.
He is so much below you.
He is so much above his situation by his abilities. So amiable. So honourable.
So much below you in birth, madam.
So is almost every man I know.
I wish you well.
There is no mercy for me in this island. Every day the paper is full of my marriage to you. I give no reason for such impertinence, but cannot deliver myself from it.
Doubtless you will return in a year or two. Go, the earlier the better.
I
would not go if you asked me.
So, see the importance of a person to himself. I fancy Dr. Johnson could not live without me, forsooth, as we have now lived together for so long. And I have so fondled him and waited on him in sickness and in health, not a bit on... He feels nothing in parting with me. nothing in the least, but thinks it is a prudent scheme and goes to his book as usual. Oh, this is philosophy and truth. I begin to see now that your connection with me was merely an interested one. Oh, you love Mr. Thrale, I believe, but only wish to find in me a careful nurse and humble friend for his sick and lounging hours. The persecution I endure from men who want to marry me is another reason for my desiring to be gone. I wish to marry none of them.
Except for Piazzi.
I really thought you could not have existed without my conversation. But you care more for my roast beef and plum pudding, which you now devour too dirtily for endurance. And since you are glad to get rid of me, I'm sure I have good cause getting rid of you.
Hester? Hester?
Not long afterwards, he had a dreadful stroke of the palsy.
It pleased God this morning to deprive me of the powers of speech. I went to bed, and in a short time waked and sat up, when I felt a confusion, an indistinctness in my head, which lasted, I suppose, about half a minute. I was alarmed, and prayed God that however he might afflict my body, he would spare my understanding. This prayer, that I might try the integrity of my faculties, I made in Latin verse. The lines were not very good, but I knew them not to be very good. Soon after, I perceived that I had suffered a paralytic stroke. I had no pain, and so little dejection in this dreadful state, that I wondered at my own apathy and considered that perhaps death itself, when it should come, would excite less horror than seems now to attend it. The world passes away, and we are passing with it. But there is doubtless another world which will endure forever. Let us all fit ourselves for it.
Now I am come to the last year of the life of Samuel Johnson. On Wednesday, May the 5th, I arrived in London and sat a part of the evening with him by ourselves. He talked of Mrs. Thrale with much concern.
Oh, she has done everything wrong since Thrale's bridle was off her neck.
I hear she's perhaps to be married.
Oh, no, no.
Poor Thrale's death was untimely. If he had had his full term, there would have been none of this. But the death of her friends might be a consolation against the fear of our own dissolution.
Oh, sir.
Because we might have more friends in the other world than in this.
Why, how can a man know where his departed friends are, or whether they will be his friends in the other world? How many friendships have you known formed upon principles of virtue?
Why, sir, our own...
Most friendships are formed by caprice or by chance, mere confederacies in vice or leagues in folly.
Would you say this of your own friends?
Langton may go to heaven, and he's an old and dear friend. I know not who will go to heaven if Langton does not.
Edmund Burke?
Yes, sir, but Mr. Burke has not the evangelical virtue of Langton. Burke, I'm afraid, would not scruple to pick up a wench.
Yes, well, if that were the sticking point...
When I fell ill, I desired Mr. Langton to tell me sincerely in what way he thought my life was faulty.
Did you so? And did he?
Sir, he brought me a sheet of paper on which he had written down several texts from Scripture recommending Christian charity. And when I questioned him what occasion I'd given for such a thing, all that he would say was that I had sometimes contradicted people in conversation. Now, what harm does it do to any man to be contradicted?
I suppose he meant the manner of doing it.
Eh?
Roughly and harshly.
And who is the worse for that?
It hurts people.
Huh?
People of weak nerves.
I know no such people.
But it is well if a man has nothing heavier on his conscience than having been a little rough in conversation. After dinner, we talked of forms of prayer.
I know of no good prayers but those in the Book of Common Prayer.
I wish, sir, you would compose some prayers for us.
I will not compose prayers for you, sir, because you can do it for yourself. I have thought of selecting some and prefixing a discourse on prayer.
I pressed him to execute this plan, but he seemed to be a little displeased at the manner of my importunity.
I know not what time God will allow me in this world. There are many things which I wish to do.
I never was more serious about anything in my life.
Let me alone! Let me alone! I'm overpowered!
And then he put his hands before his face and reclined for some time upon the table.
I'm afraid I may be one of those who shall be damned.
What do you mean by damned?
Sent to hell, sir, and punished everlastingly.
Dear sir, do you have so much upon your conscience?
I was an undutiful son. I was disobedient. I once refused to attend my father to Uttoxeter Market. Pride was the source of that refusal, and the remembrance of it was painful. A few years ago, I desired to atone for this fault. I went to Uttoxeter in very bad weather and stood for a considerable time bareheaded in the rain on the spot where my father's bookstall used to stand. In contrition I stood, and I hope the penance was expiatory.
From the subject of death, we passed to the discourse of life, whether it was upon the whole more happy or miserable.
Misery, sir. I'm decidedly for the balance of misery.
It seems strange, sir, that you, who have so often delighted the company by your lively and brilliant conversation, should say you were miserable.
Alas, it is all outside. I may be cracking my joke and cursing the sun. Sun, how I hate thy beams.
The anxiety of his friends to preserve so estimable a life made them plan for him a retreat from the severity of a British winter. The person to whom I thought I should apply to negotiate this business was the Lord Chancellor. I wrote to him, stating the case. This application was utterly unknown to Johnson himself.
My dear Bozzy, I'm rather better today.
I'm very anxious about you, sir, and particularly that you should go to Italy for the winter, which I believe is your own wish.
It is, sir.
You have no objection, I presume, but the money it would require?
I know, sir.
Then allow me to read you this. It is from the Lord Chancellor. I am much obliged to you for the suggestion, and I will adopt and press it as far as I can. It would be a reflection on us all if such a man should perish for want of the means to take care of his health.
This is taking prodigious pains about a man.
Oh, sir, your friends would do everything for you.
God bless you. God bless you all.
I also shed tears. We both remained for some time unable to speak. He rose suddenly and quitted the room. He stayed but a short time till he had recovered his firmness. Soon after, he returned. I left him, having first engaged him to dine at Sir Joshua Reynolds the next day. I was never again under that roof which I had so long reverenced. On the Wednesday, the friendly, confidential dinner with Sir Joshua took place. Had I known that this was the last time I should enjoy in this world the conversation of a friend whom I so much respected and from whom I derived so much instruction and entertainment, I should have been deeply affected. When I now look back on it, I am vexed that a single word should have been forgotten. Afterwards, I accompanied him in Sir Joshua's coach to the entry of Bolt Court. We bade adieu to each other affectionately in the carriage. When he had got down upon the foot pavement, he called out,
"Fare you well."
And without looking back, he sprung away with a kind of pathetic briskness, which seemed a struggle to conceal uneasiness. Our application to the Lord Chancellor was not successful. Soon after this time, Dr. Johnson had the mortification of being informed by Mrs. Thrale that what he supposed he never believed was true, namely that she was actually going to marry Signor Piozzi, her children's Italian music master. He endeavoured to prevent it, but in vain.
"If I interpret you aright, you are ignominiously married. If it is yet undone, let us once talk together."
"It is done, and the birth of my second husband is no meaner than my first. His sentiments are not meaner. It is merely his want of fortune, then, that is ignominious to your eyes."
"If you have abandoned your children and your religion, God forgive your wickedness."
"The religion to which Signor Piozzi has always been a zealous adherent will, I hope, teach him to forgive insults he has not deserved."
"So then, if you have forfeited your fame and your country, may your folly do you no further mischief. I, who have loved you, esteemed you, reverenced you, and served you, I, who have long thought you the first of humankind, entreat that I may once more see you."
"You have always commanded my esteem, and long enjoyed the fruits of a friendship never infringed by one harsh expression on my part. Never did I oppose your will or control your wish. But till you have changed your opinion of Mr. Piozzi, let us converse no more."
He now had very faint hopes of recovery, but there was in him still an animated and lofty spirit. I returned to my family, and I was no sooner arrived in Edinburgh than at once, as if plunged into a dreary vapour, all my spirits were extinguished. I was with much regret long silent. His last letter to me then came.
"Dear sir, I have this summer sometime amended, sometimes relapsed, but upon the whole have lost ground very much. In this uncomfortable state, your letters used to relieve. What is the reason I have them no longer? Are you sick or are you sullen? I'm sometimes afraid that your omission to write has some real cause, and should be glad to know that nothing ill has befallen you or any of your family."
I wrote him two as kind letters as I could, the last of which came too late to be read by him. On Monday, the 13th of December, he expired, about 7 o'clock in the evening, with so little apparent pain that his attendants hardly perceived when his dissolution took place. I trust I shall not be accused of affectation when I declare that I find myself unable to express all that I felt upon the loss of such a guide, philosopher and friend. But I wish he had read my letter. I dreamt that I was with my much respected friend, Dr. Johnson. I saw him distinctly, sitting in a chair opposite to me in his usual dress.
"It is an awful thing to die."
I was fully sensible that he had died some time before, yet had not the sensation of horror as if in the presence of a ghost.
"There, sir, is the difference between us. You have got happily over."
"Do not weep."
"My dear sir, pray for me."
"Dear Mr. Dilly."
"Mr. Boswell, how do you, sir? How does our magnum opus?"
I do not think it is in the power of words to convey to you how miserable I have been since I left you. I have heard you say that you never sat listless by the fire.
Indeed not.
I have, during this wretched time since the death of my friend, sat so for hours and hours.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear it.
I feel myself a poor, forlorn being with no permanent vigour of mind, no friend that can enable me to advance myself in life. And for immediate feelings, added to ennui and self-upbraiding, I am again unfortunate enough to have a sore of a certain nature, contracted, I think, from a young woman on Monday fortnight, which gives me great pain and alarm.
My dear sir.
And my fortune is sadly encumbered.
Then would you not be wise to accept my 1,000 guineas for your life of Johnson?
How can I, in all conscience? You will overprint. The curiosity about Johnson is now only in our circle. I have above 100 pages of insertions yet to be written. Besides his death and 37 letters, I go sluggishly about it. I cannot decide.
Your work is perfectly new and perfectly excellent. Take our 1,000 guineas and let me write the advertisement.
We will get no profit. The public will be disappointed. It has been preparing so long. I will make enemies. I've done it poorly.
Sir.
Oh, I miss him, Charles. I cannot do without him. I dream about him. I dream the doctor is angry with me. I'm lost without him.
But he is here, sir. In your book, he lives. You have him here.
Yes, but I do miss him.
In the second part of Boswell's Life of Johnson, dramatised by Robin Brooks, James Boswell was played by Paul Higgins, Samuel Johnson by Kenneth Cranham, Hester Thrale by Annabel Dowler, and Garrick by David Hargreaves. Mrs. Desmoulins was played by Susan Jameson, Wilkes by Philip Fox, Reynolds by Matt Addis, and Dilly by Stephen Hogan. The director was Claire Grove.
And after the weekend, we begin a four-part dramatisation of Margaret Oliphant's Phoebe Junior. We're seeing off the old year and welcoming in 2014 in style on the Radio 4 Extra Comedy Club, as the New Year Jollity is hosted by the very versatile John Shuttleworth. John will be introducing shows from Sarah Millican, Dawn French, Mark Steele and Alistair McGowan, and will be ably assisted by the ever-present Ken Worthington.
Now, before the next programme, may I officially welcome a next-door neighbour and sole agent, Ken Worthington, to the microphone. Ken, come a bit closer, please.
Oh, hello.
Yep. Ken is not a performer.
No.
Used to be. He came last on New Faces in 73.
Tony Hatch crucified me.
That's right, he did. But now Ken, you know, is not relaxed in a high-pressure situation.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, you know, so he's prone to getting tongue-tied. But let's crack on now, please, Ken. Right, listeners, Mitchell and Webb are here now. Well, when are they not here? Or there? Or somewhere in the vicinity? You know, they're everywhere.
Ubiquitous.
Pardon, Ken?
Oof,
yeah, please.
Join John, Ken and guests for a feast of funny for New Year in the Comedy Club, Monday to Thursday night from 10 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Oh, hello, and happy Christmas. More of that anon, as they say.
This Christmas, BBC Radio 4 Extra celebrates the life and work of Richard Briers.
I want excitement, adventure, I want passion.
Life is like a swimming pool. All the noise comes from the shallow end.
Would it be a good idea if you stopped with me for a bit? Would you like that?
A day of comedy and drama from the BBC archive, with the recollections of his friends and family.
You don't have to think about Richard for very long, but you either smile or you laugh.
Richard Briers, Ever Increasing Wonder. Catch up on the BBC Radio 4 Extra website.
Question 1. Where can you hear the original pilot edition of the News Quiz? Question 2. When can you encounter the classic long-running quiz show Have a Go? And for your final bonus point, where can you check out such quizzical gems as Many a Slip and 20 Questions? Well, the answer to all these questions, in fact, is to join me, Russell Davis, and I'll be hosting 3 hours of foraging through the BBC Radio archives to bring you the best quizzes and panel games.
Let's get quizzical. Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Mel's here next. I'll see you at 5 with Capital Gains.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see. Every couple tries to stop.
Oh, darlings, come on in. Come on, welcome to the last of this week's festive 4 o'clock shows with me, Mel Gedroych. You're so welcome. Could you please take off your shoes? There is a coat hook, if you'd be so kind to use it. Thank you. Very lovely of you all to come to our Christmas party. Lots of warm Christmassy kisses. There we go. Lovely. Now, sorry, do you know everyone here? Yes? Yes? Clarissa, this is Jim. Bernard, this is Keith. Good. Oh, yes. Oh, hang on. You think you've seen the old guy in the corner before? I know, it's difficult to place him, isn't it? You won't recognise him because he's smiling. Yeah, I know, it completely transforms his face, doesn't it? Yeah, that's our... He's a neighbour. We thought we'd better invite him. He's called Ebenezer Scrooge. Yeah, I know, he's in such a good mood. Don't know what happened, but I wouldn't have recognised him either.
Really, for a man who had been out of practice for so many years, it was a splendid laugh. A most illustrious laugh. The father of a long, long line of brilliant laughs.
Thank goodness Scrooge has seen the light. David Jason will be back towards the end of the show with the last episode of Charles Dickens' classic A Christmas Carol. And no wonder old Scroogey is smiling, because Mary Bezza Berry is also on the show with her recipe for chocolate roulade.
Oh, look at it, it's all cracked. It should be cracked. A little bit of icing sugar over the top there.
Yes, it is a thing of absolute beauty, that. You're just putting a little sprig of holly on the top.
And our special, very intrepid Christmas panto reporter, Sanjeev Kohli, brings back one last Christmas treat from the magical, sparkly, becrankied world of panto. All coming up on the 4 o'clock show today. But before we do anything else, we've got a magical mystery tour to begin. This place is covered with ice, glaciers and geysers. He's a geyser, isn't he? And it has more than 20 active volcanoes. Where are we going? More clues coming up later in the show. Stay tuned. Now, do you have a favourite Christmas noise? Well, listener Maureen McGregor has, and she made a sound sculpture of it for BBC Radio 4's Saturday Live.
My name is Maureen McGregor, and my favourite sound is the sound that a parcel makes when it's being squeezed or poked or pummeled, when you're trying to find out what's inside. That lovely crackly sort of noise. Just as soon as I hear the noise, it takes me back to when I was about 6 years old, Christmas morning, waking up in the early hours of the morning, still in the dark, no idea what time it was. And somebody must have told me that if Santa comes and you're still awake, then he'll go away again. So I was always terrified of looking as though I was awake. So my method was to keep my eyes tightly closed and inch 1 foot down the bed very, very slowly until I heard that noise, that lovely, crinkly, crackly noise in a little bedroom. Was like fireworks almost. Then I dared to open my eyes and have a look and see all the lovely red and green and sparkly paper there, and that noise just means he's been, Santa's been, you know?
Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town.
I have got a parcel here. This is actually to me from my son, which is under my Christmas tree, and I haven't opened it yet. It's a special sort of rustle. I think it's that the Christmas paper is different from other paper. It usually has some metallic on it. This particular parcel, it's gold paper with some green glitter on it. Each one that I open, I have to go through this ritual of squeezing and pummeling and poking it to try and guess what's inside it. And that noise is part of it. It wouldn't be the same if it wasn't wrapped up in the paper. The soft parcels make the best noise, but weren't always the best present. They were quite often a jumper or a pair of socks from your auntie, which wasn't as exciting, but they always made the most exciting noise. Whatever the present is, however cheap it is, whether it's a little token present or an expensive present, I always take a long time. It's always wrapped in tissue paper and Christmas paper and ribbons, and I do take pride in what